Check. Check 1, 2. It works. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. You know the great part about having your own podcast and having lots of people listen to it is you get to share things with those people that they might not have actually had shared with them. You get to introduce people to relationships that you have and knowledge that you've come into over the course of your life. And I believe in the alchemy of life. I really, really do. I believe that embracing fate, I believe in educating yourself, I believe in leaning into different teachings from different people who've experienced things that you want to experience. And today is one of those days that I get to talk to one of those people that's made a great big difference in my life, and I imagine the lives of many others. He's an author, and he is, without knowing it, one of the intellectual, philosophical mentors that I have in my life, and he's one of those guys that you latch on to because you're like, oh my God, everything he says makes sense. He's the author of this book that I read that really did change how I think about things and dealing with life, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, the Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius, that along with Ryan Holiday, who actually did the foreword for it, is one of those popularizers and educators, somebody that brings something to your attention and is able to connect with you in a way that makes sense to you, that offers you some relief, some tools of life. And without further ado, Donald J. Robertson joins us to talk about his new book, Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Emperor, which I had the pleasure of reading last night. And he joins us on the podcast today. This is one of those interviews that I love doing. Please welcome to the program, Mr. Donald J. Robertson, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Robertson, nice to see you. How are you?
Hi, Dean. I'm awesome. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Where are you coming at us from today? Are you in Canada?
From the great nation of Quebec, from Montreal. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that where you posted up there? You're obviously Scottish, right?
Yeah. How could you tell?
Well, it's in the accent. Like,
so, and the name is what, like, yeah, I live in Quebec now. I lived in Toronto for a while and I moved about a year ago here.
Okay. Did any reason you just like Quebec? More sensible? A little bit cheaper than Toronto?
It's a lot cheaper than Toronto. It was, I like foreign stuff. Yeah. Like, my wife likes European stuff. She comes from Michigan. And I spent some time living in Greece as well. Don't speak a lick of French.
No.
Like,
is it hard when you're an Anglophone or someone that doesn't speak French to live in Quebec?
No.
People you can get by?
I think it's all relative. I mean, I'm self-employed, so that makes it a little bit easier. Like, I don't work for it, but I don't have any problem not speaking. I find if you're in a country where you don't speak language, as long as you're patient and polite with people, absolutely fine. Like, it's only when you kind of get, like, shirty about it and stuff that it causes friction. That's my view.
Well, yeah, that's kind of pretty standard with, like, life in general, not even just being a foreigner in a different country. You catch more flies with honey than turds, as my dad used to say.
Yeah.
Should be a stoic value, to be honest with you. Let's talk about the book a little bit. Donald, this is a new book. I tried to get you on the show a while ago, but you were writing this book, and I know you're perpetually writing books.
Yeah.
This is out now. It is a bestseller on Amazon, Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Emperor. Tell me a little bit about it. I read it yesterday. I found it fascinating because you include Hadrian in here, in this book. And Hadrian is not a guy that Marcus Aurelius in the Meditations was like, let me thank all these people. Hadrian was conspicuously absent. So tell me about the book and how you arrived at that storyline.
Well, I wanted to write a bit more. I got invited by Yale University Press to write a biography. I often get asked to write books. And my reaction is, well, what's the point? It's already been done. So there are many biographies of Marcus Aurelius. And at first I thought, what's the point in writing another one? And I thought, well, how could I write a biography that's different? And as I got deeper into that, I thought, really, there are lots of things that I could add to this. You know, the other biographies I didn't feel said enough about Marcus's attitude towards slavery or his attitude towards Christians, or they didn't say enough about how he was influenced by his philosophy, funnily enough. So I really wanted to put that straight and write a book about the Roman Emperor that would appeal to people that like movies like Gladiator, you know, that would be dramatic and interesting, but that would also maybe give them a bit of a role model and just give them a few kind of hints. It's not a self-help book, but hopefully when people read it, you know, more than a normal biography, they take away some kind of inspiration for, you know, what it would mean to live in accord with Stoic philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in nature, in accordance with nature, which I found you know, really interesting, and is someone that practices really, and I mean, I stress the practice part, stoicism, because it's, you know, you're up, you're down, we're emotional beings. You know, one of the things that I got out of that book was there was a human need for Marcus Aurelius to dig into self. There was a human need as a young man, and that was the backstory that you offer and how you color in the things that went into him. Right. Well,
we're talking earlier about how some of the great leaders in history are kind of boring, and we forget about them because they just get on and do the job. They don't get involved in controversy and stuff like that. And Marcus was preceded by Hadrian. So a little bit of quick history. The Emperor Hadrian, towards the end of his reign, became a bit of a despot, went a bit crazy, you know, was mired in controversy. But he chose another man called Antoninus Pius to succeed him as emperor. And then Hadrian also arranged for Marcus Aurelius to succeed Antoninus. So he had this long-term succession policy. And Marcus, who saw Hadrian towards the end of his life, I think obviously thought, wow, first of all, I think he thought, I don't want anything to do with politics, right? I don't want to get sucked into the world that corrupted this guy and made this train wreck. And then luckily for him, he saw Antoninus succeed Hadrian, and he thought, well, this guy's the opposite. Like, he's totally rational, you know, he's very patient, like, very level-headed, you know, he's not corrupt in the way that Hadrian was. And so Marcus spent his life, I think, trying to refine his own character so that he could emulate this good role model that he had and avoid becoming like the kind of negative role model that had preceded him.
Yeah, and that role model that he became was out of necessity, right? And that was the backstory in the first part of the book. I think it was chapter one, chapter two, where you get into Lucilla, his mother, you know, and their living arrangement and how he had to go and where he had to live, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I find that fascinating psychologically, cognitively, for a couple of reasons. One is we invent these alternative realities in moments of extreme stress, right? Like where we have, and it's this human need, this psychological need that we have when we're in these moments to be able to survive.
Yeah.
And I found that to be one of the more fascinating parts of the book, where it was, hey, listen, Marcus Aurelius, yes, incredible man. Yeah, we have the meditations because those are his journals. Wasn't supposed to share them. Yeah, you know, being able to focus on what's right, being able to, you know, what's in your control, what's not in your control. That was a derivative of him surviving what appears to be really a tough childhood.
Well, maybe we'll talk a lot about Hadrian then. We might as well.
Yeah.
You know, provide the context. So it's funny, like, other biographies hadn't leaned as much into
at all
and kind of explained how this really molded Marcus. And there are always in history, there are parallels that you can draw with the recent history that we live in. So there are weird parallels. Let's point out the obvious parallels between Hadrian and Donald Trump, shall we? All right. So number one, who's famous? Which political leader, here's a quiz for you, Dean, is famous
for
building a wall or attempting to build a really expensive wall to keep out foreign immigrants, like, and making that a kind of, what would you say, a sort of manifesto, you know, like
a mandate,
a part of their legacy that they wanted to have, right? Hadrian built Hadrian's Wall, clues in the name, right? He named it after himself.
Oh, it wasn't just a clever name? Is that what you're saying?
It was like he wanted his name on everything, right? Yeah. This wasn't unusual in the ancient world, but Hadrian founded several cities that he named after himself. He committed genocide, according to some scholars, in Judea, like against the Jewish people. They had a war following the Bar Kokhba revolt. And he renamed the whole nation as Syria Palestina rather than Judea. And he renamed Jerusalem, the capital city, after himself, right? So he would like put like Trump Tower or something. Hadrian was surprisingly involved in infrastructure and constructing buildings and monuments
all over that area too, right? Like it was Hadrian's Door, Hadrian's Wall, Hadrian's Arches, and they're all over that area.
My favorite is in Athens. They have Hadrian's Arch still standing to this day, and he built it on the edge of the ancient city of Athens, separating an area that the Romans had built. And on one side, it says, this is Athens, the city of Theseus, who is the legendary founder of Athens. And on the other side, it says, this is the city of Hadrian and not of Theseus. right? So he's like emphatic, like I
all egos,
right? Just so you guys know, this like legendary founder built that fair, but I built the rest of it, right? Let's be crystal clear about that, and it still stands in the middle of Athens, right? So it's total ego, like stamping his name over everything.
Which is weird because he was one of the like four or five good emperors, right? Allegedly. Like he's reported as. And so like taking us through in this, you know, and I've done some learning since you sent me the book, you taking me through Hadrian's ego was truly incredible. And it really leans into why he didn't appear in that first chapter of Meditations.
The reason for it, in a way, I mean, let's dig even deeper into the origin of it and the psychology. Hadrian wasn't born in Rome. Right, he was from Hispania Baetica, like came from Spain, and he was provincial, number one. And we're told that when he arrived in Rome, he was ridiculed for having a regional accent, right? So he was a classic example of an outsider leader, right? He saw himself as not fitting in. He hated the establishment in Rome and the political elite and the senatorial class. Much like Donald J. Trump sees himself as an outsider, campaigns as an outsider, what's it they call it, draining the swamp, and the difference is that Hadrian literally had the senators beheaded. Like, he had political purges. He locked a bunch of them up. He had a bunch of them executed.
Oh, he just went the extra mile. Hadrian was like Donald Trump on roids.
He had the freedom to just go like a little bit. So, and also he wasn't elected. He was acclaimed by the legions, but there was a scandal about the way that he acquired power that kind of tainted his entire reign. So Trajan was the preceding emperor. Trajan died without designating an heir and left behind a will that's designated Hadrian allegedly as his successor, you know, but there were rumors that it was forged, right? Mm-hmm. So right from the outset, Hadrian's rise to power was shrouded in controversy about the legitimacy, you know, like whether there'd been fraud or like election fraud today.
Are you saying the election was rigged?
The election was rigged, man. Like, it wasn't, the succession was rigged. Like, totally. So they all thought the succession was rigged. And there were a bunch of his rivals, like top senators, who presumably were like, this succession is rigged. They all got beheaded. Right? A bunch of others got thrown in prison. And then the next thing that Hadrian does in order to consolidate power, so again, because he's not elected, he can't be a populist in the sense that someone like Donald Trump might be, but he does the equivalent. He leaves Rome and goes around the provinces. This is unusual for an emperor.
He's a traveling emperor, right? He spent like half of his reign out of Rome.
Like becoming popular, trying to show that he's got the common touch, building monuments everywhere to kind of like leave his impression on them. So gaining popularity with the common people in these kind of neglected backwaters of the empire, if you like, in order to consolidate his power. And that's to offset the fact that the Senate can't stand him. You know, the elites in Rome can't stand him. And that actually kind of worked okay. Until he got ill and his boyfriend turned up dead at the bottom of the Nile. He had to come home. Once he came home, back home to Rome, like it all went crazy again because he and the Senate were like at each other's throats. And he had spies everywhere, opening people's letters, like paid informers, like, but also he went after several members of Marcus Aurelius's family, his extended family, that he thought were involved in plots against him. So he became obsessed with the idea that people were conspiring against him. You know, he put people on trial, he stripped them of office, he exiled them. You know, he had a couple of people executed again. He promised that he would not execute anyone else. And then the thing that the Senate really held against him was the fact that he didn't even keep that promise. Like, eventually went, damn it. No, I'm going to just have to execute someone else. Sorry. Yeah. I know I promised.
But I swear.
So their impression of him was that he was a naturally violent and despotic ruler. Yeah. He managed to kind of keep that suppressed for quite a while by staying out of Rome. But then when he came back, it just exploded again, and he just went on a bunch of paranoid, revenge-fueled kind of vendettas.
Yeah.
And so, like, as an outsider ruler, you know, there's some parallels that you can draw with Trump, the friction with the political class that he obviously felt. That a part of that, like Nixon as well, there's this kind of arrogance that he wants to prove that he's better than the elites. So Hadrian was incredibly boastful, different from Trump. Hadrian was claimed to be an intellectual, right? Trump's claimed to have a high IQ and stuff, hasn't he? Like,
well, yeah. He's got all the best words, Donald.
Yeah, he's got all the best words. Hadrian tried to actually be a writer and a poet. He wanted to compete with intellectuals. He got really annoyed with them and had vendettas against intellectuals when they disagreed with him.
Yeah, like we see today, the stripping of intellectual and academic institutions, right?
Yeah. And he founded a school as well called the Athenaeum. And, you know, like, again, a little bit like Trump wanting to have the Trump. Hadrian was more successful in that regard, though. Like, he actually could write poetry. But he overestimated. He was very narcissistic and very arrogant and very boastful and kind of known for that. In some ways, that's compensating against the fact that he was looked down on by the elite. Mm-hmm. So he tried to build his base with the provinces and the common people, as it were. Like, but towards the end of his life, it's almost like a kind of
amazing parallels, though, Donald. Like, if just like, you know, you're taking me through it, and we're talking about, you know, the subversion of democracy. We're talking about the illusion that you are something you are not. We're talking about, you know, putting up monuments. Like, you know, you talk about Hadrian's arches and how petty the inscription was on the other side. Donald Trump put up a plaque on one of his golf courses saying, "Here stands one of the greatest Civil War death experiences of all time. And I'm just proud to own this property, Donald J. Trump." Like, you know, it's amazing. And it leans into, when I read the book, obviously you color in a whole bunch of details, but it's amazing the parallels that you can draw from what went into making Marcus Aurelius.
I'll give you another one.
Yeah, please.
Another really obvious one, right? When Hadrian got back to Rome, because he couldn't even stand to live there, like normally the emperor would stay in a mansion, a villa on the Palatine Hill. That's where we get the word palace from, incidentally. And so he'd be kind of at the center of political power in Rome. Hadrian, because he couldn't get on with any of the politicians, built a massive villa complex at Tibur outside of Rome, like miles outside of Rome. Right, it was this huge, opulent-like estate, and he had his political meetings, and he ruled from there, like from outside of Rome, a bit like Mar-a-Lago, right? But actually, to Donald Trump's shout, like the Hadrian's villa is approximately, I think, 10 times the size of Mar-a-Lago. Someone should tell Trump that.
Yeah, there's like 300 acres, 30 buildings, huge. Massive.
Yeah, there are 30 buildings in it.
Yeah.
Like, so he's almost kind of like, you know, saying this is part of his autocracy. He's like, I'm not even going to rule from Rome anymore. I'm just going to build my own like center of power here, like, and rule the empire from my personal estate, like outside of Rome. So I guess a part of it is that many people will think of the emperors as inherently autocratic, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of spectrum. Like, some emperors, like, just completely ignored the Senate, like, you know, executed senators that didn't agree with them, were very autocratic, ruled like kings, or what we would think of as an emperor today. But other emperors were more like statesmen, and they saw themselves as collaborating with the Senate, as sharing power with them. So Marcus Aurelius and Antoninus, we're told, would not make any major appointments or approve any major expenditure of state funds without getting Senate approval first. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Hadrian would just do it.
Yeah, like, royal decrees, right? Like, that's how he operated.
So he would use like executive orders, if you like, to bypass the Senate, essentially. Whereas, you know, Marcus thought, like, if you hit one point, some people, we're told that both Marcus and Antoninus, there's an interesting kind of paradox that you find in ancient literature that they're conscious of. Mm-hmm. They say some rulers use the threat of violence or fear to control, to hang on to power. Whereas they say a truly great ruler uses the threat of stepping down from office. So Pericles famously did that, the great statesman of Athens. He said, I'm going to, like, he kind of implied that he would, I'll step down from politics. Like, if he couldn't get something approved, and they say, well, we're not totally sure, but we'd rather just like approve this than lose you.
Yeah.
Because we love
Antoninus,
you.
Like, Antoninus, too. Antoninus did that famously where he's
very
like,
interesting.
Right? Where he's like, you need to deify Hadrian, or I'm not going to take over as emperor.
Yes, yeah, his fault that we think of Hadrian as one of the good emperors in a way. Like, because the Senate hated Hadrian. They wanted to annul all of his acts. They wanted to consign him to what they called damnatio memoriae, where they just kind of like...
You stripe his name. Yeah.
Never existed. Yeah. Struck out from history, right? Like, so they wanted to condemn him publicly as a tyrant and a bad emperor. Mm-hmm. And Antoninus said, let's not do that. Let's like them. That makes us kind of like as bad as him, right? Let's just kind of like draw a line under it and move on. Give him his deification. And let's concentrate on just getting things back to normal. And he said, you know, he chose me as his successor. So, you know, I'll step down like from that role. Like, if you guys want to basically carry on these vendettas, it has to stop. Mm-hmm. Like, and so they said, okay, we want to have you so much as our emperor. We don't want to lose you. And that Marcus Aurelius was kind of, at one point we're told, and this is inconceivable, but we're told it's true, that when civil war broke out under Marcus Aurelius, he wrote a letter to the Senate saying that he would have been willing to step down from office and appear in front of a Senate hearing voluntarily alongside the emperor that had instigated the civil war against him, self-proclaimed emperor. And he said, you could hear us both out, like, and you could decide which one you want to carry on ruling. Like, would be the, I mean, who in the right mind would what autocrat, like, in the right mind would offer to do that? He said, well, I'll just stand down. And if you want, you could reacclaim me emperor, or you could choose him. Like, you guys decide. Because he knew, like, the Senate would be, no, we want to keep you. Right? Like, you've been a good emperor so far. We'd be crazy to, like, trade you in for this psychopath that's kind of, you know, broken away. Right, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but that's more violent. this guy, I mean, the way that the histories portray Avidius Cassius is like a psychopath, but I presume that he wasn't quite that bad.
You never know, right? Because history, this is kind of what I love about history, is that, you know, you've got people that have been wiped off of the map when it comes to history. You've got people that are misrepresented. I mean, the Bible itself has been re-engineered several times, and we're told that history is what it is. And we, you know, we line up with who we believe, but it's close to the text as possible, which is what I loved also about the book. By the way, Donald J. Robertson joins us. He is a cognitive behavioral therapist. He's also a practicing Stoic. He is a historian. This new book, he's a best-selling author, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor, really gets to some of the greasier parts of that time in history as well, right? And one of the things that it deals with is pederastia, you know, pedophilia. Like that, we talk about why Marcus Aurelius was what he was. And a lot of people seem to think that, you know, oh, he's just this exceptional individual, but he and his father, Antoninus, had to deal with a lot of the things that 2000 years from then we are dealing with today. Right. And there are black marks on the perception of Stoicism and the perception of philosophy back in the day. But, I mean, going a little bit further to explain the kind of individual that Marcus Aurelius was and what he robed himself in terms of truth and being right and being righteous, I mean, you know, it also leans into, the book itself leans into the darker parts of the time and what went into making Marcus Aurelius this individual and why we have meditations today.
Well, right? TikTok tells us that men think about the Roman Empire, what, twice a week or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, did you remember that trend? What did you think of that when that trend happened?
I thought it was interesting. Like, it kind of...
But people used it to say, if you think about the Roman Empire more than twice a day, you might be a douchebag. That was one of the narratives I liked.
I don't know, like, I think about the Roman Empire every day. But the Romans thought about Alexander the Great at least twice a week, basically. So it's always kind of like this inception. If you think deeply enough about the Roman Empire, you end up thinking about ancient Greece. So... You're touching on, like, so let's go where angels fear to tread, right?
Sure.
So, like, I'll preface this by saying it's virtually impossible to have a sensible discussion about this, but we'll have a go anyway. So,
I'm really glad you're here for this because I wouldn't do it on my own. Thanks.
So, in ancient Greece, we believe that it was normal for older men, at least in elite society, to have probably sexual relationships with adolescent boys. And there's still a great deal of academic controversy about the nature of those relationships and how common they were. But nobody can read Plato, for example, and not notice that he talks a lot about erotic, romantic, sexualized relationships between older men and adolescent boys. Like, in the context, they happened at the gymnasia, like, where young men would go to wrestle naked and older men would go to watch them. Right. And this was a kind of an accepted part of the culture in a way. And, you know, one of the I'll make a connection between this and modern society that might not be obvious at first. But in ancient Athens, women were treated almost like slaves, and they weren't really women typically weren't allowed outdoors except in a very limited sphere. There were certain parts of the Agora market that they were allowed into, but not others. They weren't allowed to set foot in the gymnasia. So the life of women was very, very restricted.
Really? Really? Kept, Hellenic women too? Greek women?
Yeah, they were kept indoors a lot of the time, with a few notable exceptions, right? There's always kind of outliers, but generally women were kind of almost like slaves. They were like locked up indoors. There would be a separate part of the house for them, and then a part where the men met. And I think the impression I get often is that when women married, which they often did pretty young, like about 15, you know, maybe a little bit older. So they'd marry them off as early as they could, basically. But they'd often marry older, wealthier men, especially in elite society. Now, I think there's two things there that cause a problem that changes the sexual mores of society. One is that the women are just kind of kept up, locked up a lot of time. There are prostitutes, like, in certain areas, but it's not like what we think of as a kind of free democratic society.
No, they were just at the hedonism school.
Yeah, like, they were, like, you can't just go down a bar and kind of, like, meet, you know, like, so...
Yeah, Rome had a red light district, right?
Yeah.
Athens had a red light district. This is the world's oldest profession, Donald.
But young men were quite restricted in terms of the type of the women that they could potentially meet. And because these women would often, I think, marry older men, like the kind of market, if you like, for young men, they were limited in the scope of women that were available to them sexually, not to put too fine a point on it. And so that led, surprise, surprise, to increased prevalence of bisexuality or homosexuality as a kind of inevitable solution to it, as it were. Now, I mean, it's different again, but there are obviously some parallels between that and incel culture, like in the 21st century. So you go on the incel boards and stuff, and they have elaborate theories about how, like, women are no longer accessible to them.
Yeah.
Like, and I think, well, that sounds like the ancient world in a way, like young guys, you know, didn't have like access. They couldn't just meet girlfriends as easily. Like, you know, young women tended to be married to older men. Women didn't go outdoors much. They could go and have sex with prostitutes if they wanted, but there's some risk associated with that and some kind of like taboos associated with it and things like that. So they're pretty limited. It wasn't just like today where boys and girls hang out together and can mingle and, you know, you have lots of girlfriends, you know, growing up and going to university and things like that. That was kind of denied to them in the way that incels claim that, you know, that they experience life.
Yeah, that they don't have access to women, and the women they do have access to, they don't feel like they are worthy of their company, right? Yeah, it's amazing. Another parallel. The Dean Blundell Show is brought to you by FactCheck.io. FactCheck.io, makers of the world's most comprehensive fact-checking software, that have been very busy building some software so that you can fact check anything that you read. It doesn't matter if it's got a URL, you'll be able to fact check it. Alternative sources, origins, whether or not it was an organic or inorganic campaign,
whether or not you can trust the people that are putting out the information so that you can give yourself agency over information in the age of disinformation. Again, want to beta test their product? They're going to launch it in the next month or two. Go to factcheck.io today. FAKTCHEK.io. Back to the show. As always, the Dean Blundell Show is brought to you by our friends at factcheck.io. Factcheck.io. Do you believe? The good people at FactCheck are a quorum of software professionals, psychological professionals, journalists that have been very busy building some software so that you can fact check anything that you read. It doesn't matter if it's got a URL, you'll be able to fact check it. Alternative sources, origins, whether or not it was an organic or inorganic campaign, whether or not you can trust the people that are putting out the information and alternative sources. And there's going to be a weapon button too, where you can turn that information around and put it back out there accurately to combat disinformation. The good people at factcheck.io are right now testing their beta version of their free program. Yes, it will be free for anybody who wants to use it. They want to battle disinformation because it is a problem. Go to factcheck.io today. FAKTCHEK.io. FAKTCHEK.io. The world's most robust fact-checking disinformation software for news, social media, video, print, anything spoken word. These people are on the tip. And they use some of the finest software technology to be able to give you the advantage when it comes to getting agency back in your life, when it comes to information that you read. Go to factcheck.io today for more information. Sign up for the beta test, FAKTCHEK.io. That's crazy.
I'll tell you one other parallel, like, because, I mean, we could be all over the shop with this, but I'm just hoping we throw out some nuggets and it makes people interested in this stuff.
Absolutely.
So I should mention the connection here that Hadrian was notorious for being obsessed with Greek culture. He was a Philhellene, a Hellenophile. Like, and, you know, he was the first emperor to grow a beard. And
so yeah, didn't Romans make fun of him? Or like, oh, there's the Greek Roman. Yeah,
they thought he was like, you know, he was known for being obsessed with Greek culture. But yeah, part of the reason for that was that Romans had this kind of pederastia to some extent as well, but they saw it as a Greek thing. Like, and it's no coincidence that Hadrian spent a lot of time in Greece, because Hadrian is one of the Roman emperors that is reputed to have been
amazing sexual appetite across the spectrum.
He may have been a sex tourist in a sense, and that's why he went to these, because that's where he met Antinous, on his travels in the provinces, who was probably, we think, about 12 years old.
He died at 19 on the Nile.
When he was 19. So it ended very tragically. He was one of the most famous figures in the ancient world, in a sense. So Hadrian was into this thing that the Romans saw as kind of, they weren't sure what to make it. Some Romans thought this is fine. It's what the Greeks traditionally did. Other Romans, like Antoninus and Marcus, frowned on it and thought we need to kind of draw a line under this.
Sure, yeah.
But the other parallel that I was going to mention is that I find quite eerie is, you see in Plato, in the Gorgias, for example, one of Plato's most famous dialogues, and also in the Republic, Plato's most famous dialogue, he depicts the Sophists, who were these intellectuals of the period. Now, very simply, Dean, like, the Sophists were pseudo-philosophers, right? Socrates says they look and sound like, people think they are philosophers, but what they're doing is fundamentally different. They're really orators and rhetoricians. They give speeches that pander to the public, and they literally compete against each other to see who's going to get the biggest round of applause, and they win a prize. And they become fabulously wealthy. So they teach people what we get the word sophistication from, sophists. Yep. So they taught, well, they only really taught wealthy young men, mainly nobles, people from wealthy and powerful families. And they taught them how to improve their character. So the Sophists taught a kind of broadly defined kind of self-improvement gurus, right? They became celebrities, like podcasters or in social media. It was all driven by views. It was driven by size of the crowd. And so they ended up inevitably pandering to that and saying and doing sensational things, like, that got them the most attention, because then they would attract the biggest audiences. But the other thing that Sophists did was that they were political advisors, like spin doctors, as we call them today, or
media,
like
fake
PR
news.
Consultants. Yeah. So they advised political leaders and wrote their speeches and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So what you get is this weird amalgam of political rhetoric and self-improvement, right? Now, I used to think, well, it's like a weird thing that happened in the ancient world. But over the past 10 years or so, this has now become so prevalent in our culture that it's almost the norm. The most obvious example of it being Jordan Peterson, like, who works for the Daily Wire and talks about climate change. And, like, you know, he's highly politicized, is he not?
Did you see his tweet the other day, Donald? This tweet where I think AP Associated Press put out a thing. It's like, hey, everybody, since we moved all of these, you know, parking meters, we've had no accidents in the last 7 years. Yeah. And Jordan Peterson's like, you woke jerks. I can't believe
woke death or something it said. Like, anyway, but Dean, that's the tip of the iceberg, right? Like, but anyway, like, what, like, I try to be as sober about this as I can, like, and not mock Jordan Peterson. It's hard not to make fun because he says,
well, that's the problem I have as a Stoic. I got to tell you something, but let's just take a quick stop here, because I look at you as, and I'm sure you get a lot of people that say this to you because of the books you've written, because of your Stoic leanings, because of how you can explain history and repeat itself, and the cognitive nature of the work that you do, right? It's made a big difference in my life. So sometimes when Jordan Peterson tweets some craziness, I'm like, and then literally I've got Donald J. Robertson, the Stoic sage, on my shoulder going, don't do it, Dean. Don't do it. Don't mock him, because what's bad for the hive is bad for the bee, bro. Like, literally, that's how I think.
But, you know, in a way, these guys thrive on controversy. Like, in a sense, they love it when people ridicule them and mock them, because it just gets them more. There's no such thing as bad publicity, right? In a sense,
I don't think Jordan Peterson's wired like that. I don't think he likes us
it
mocking
hurts.
Him. Yeah, well, because what he does is he'll send me a DM, or he'll send me a tweet telling me to take off or leave him alone.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll get one from Roger Stone the other day.
Did you really?
Yeah, like, I don't know how he noticed the fact that I'd mentioned him in I was talking about his book. Anyway, that aside, the culture wars would be an example of where, and Andrew Tate would be another example, like, of people combining quasi-political rhetoric, like about the culture wars and gender and all that kind of stuff, with allegedly self-improvement, self-help advice. Is it not? These guys do self-help. They also bang on about the culture wars and wars. Boom. That happened in ancient Athens, in ancient Rome. And that was exactly what the sophists did, and exactly what Socrates and the Stoics were warning us against. To put it very simply, political rhetoric and self-improvement advice, when you combine them together, it should be obvious that it's a bad combination of things. It's a toxic combination. Political rhetoric is not about helping you. Mm-mm. It has no interest in your self-improvement. Mm-mm. The culture wars is not therapeutic, right? Shock horror. So it should set alarm bells ringing like crazy when these guys immerse themselves in it, like, go on about it all the time and also claim to be helping you. Right? They clearly, it's like oil and water. These are two things that do not combine. Mm-hmm. And they didn't combine in the ancient world either. That's why Socrates said, these guys are pretend philosophers, right? You know, what they're doing has got nothing to do with the pursuit of truth. It's all about pandering. Mm. And it's all about playing to your prejudices and amplifying them and making them worse. They don't care about the truth. Correct. Like, they just care about getting you riled up and getting you their attention junkies, right? Like, they just want the views and they want the attention. That's how they become super rich, and it works, right? Because they're playing on your weaknesses. Like, and this is what we find today, right? But I think there are many things, many angles that we could adopt on that. But I think that the obvious, the best line of critique against this whole thing is that for people who claim to be doing psychological self-help, so there are three main categories of negative emotion, right? Broadly speaking, in simple terms, anxiety, sadness, and anger, right? Anger, fear, and sadness, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People who suffer from sadness or depression, or suffer from fear or anxiety, typically go to therapy or go and do self-help. There's some exceptions, but generally speaking, they're much more likely to want to help themselves. They take a lot of responsibility for it. They become introspective. They feel guilty. Like, you know, they seek help. People who predominantly suffer from anger are the opposite. Like, they usually blame everyone else for the problems they're experiencing. So they don't tend to self-refer to treatment. They do sometimes wind up in treatment. It may be if they're depressed and they have some anger. Maybe they've got PTSD and they have some anger. So they come for their depression and anxiety, and anger comes into the treatment as a secondary presenting problem. Mm. But they don't usually come mainly because they're angry. When they end up in therapy, it's because someone else refers them. So it'll be their spouse. It'll be if they're in an institution like the military, in a school, in a prison, that other people might say, you need to go to a therapist and do something about your anger, buddy, mm-hmm. right? But they'll be like, no, you need to go and see a therapist. You're the ones that need therapy, not me. Like, it's basically, you know, how angry people think. It's an externalizing emotion, yeah. right? Yeah. So, but it seems to me the obvious flaw with Andrew Tate, Jordan Peterson, like a whole bunch of all these guys that combine political rhetoric in the culture wars with alleged self-help, is that they clearly, their rhetoric is all about blaming everyone else, blaming cultural Marxists, or in Jordan Peterson's case, women, in Andrew Tate's case, Muslims, in other cases, you know, maybe
media, whoever.
Right, but blame, it's all blaming other people, so it's about disowning response. For all the irony is, they go on about tidy your bed or whatever, like
clean your room, clean your room and pet a cat, Donald. Those are the two most important rules,
So clean your room, but blame everyone else for your problems somehow are compatible in their mind, like in the crazy double think of this, not like. If you're really angry with Muslims, or you're really, really angry, you know, like with people that disagree with your politics or whatever, maybe you could ask yourself, or you're angry with women, like maybe you should ask yourself why you get so angry about this and other people are more able to view it objectively. Like, so are you responsible for the beliefs that make you angry or the values that make you angry in the first place? Is what philosophy, cognitive therapy, and stoicism would say. But these guys don't do that. There's a reason that Jordan Peterson never mentions cognitive therapy, because he wants to naturalize anger and say that it's normal for you to be angry if you're rejected by a woman, because he wants to fuel it and encourage you to blame other people. And he makes these videos where he's literally kind of screaming down the camera or breaking into tears or whatever it is he's doing, and emoting and using the rhetoric of aggression and prejudice. Like, you know, he'll go on about, like, ranting, you know, about Trudeau or whatever it is that he's going on about that particular day, about cultural Marxists and stuff. You know, creating bogeymen, scapegoats, like that. This is not compatible.
Surgeons, let's go after surgeons that you don't like. Let's go after different people that are in and around cultures that he's trying to assimilate into his war machine. Right? It's the same thing. It's always it's their fault. Let's go.
How
after
is this
them.
Therapy? Like, you know, how is this self-help? It's obvious that if you rant about it, what you're doing is stoking people's anger, rather than asking them to reflect on their anger. So I don't know. I could be wrong about this. Right, but we could test it, right?
I don't think you are. Something tells me you're not wrong about Jordan Peterson.
There's a way of checking, right? So we could go, how do we check? We could look at the comments on his YouTube videos, right? And I don't know, does it seem like there are a lot of people commenting on them that have managed to overcome their anger? Or is it possible that he's surrounded by a kind of horde of angry young men who are getting angrier as a result of listening to the stuff that he's saying? Are they getting more? Ask yourself this question, Dean. The people that watch all those videos and read those books and stuff like that, follow Andrew Tate, Jordan Peterson, or other, like the other kind of watered down versions of them. Like, are these people getting more angry, or are they getting less angry as a result of consuming that content? What do you think?
More.
I'd say more. Like, I mean, I don't. I get that impression. I could be wrong.
You bring up a good point, right? Like, if the guy is supposed to be a self-help guru and you're angry,
why is he making them more angry?
Why are you still angry, bro? Like, it's pretty simple stuff. Like, it should be working by now, right? Like, I mean, you got a few years of runway, but to your point, you mentioned Jordan Peterson, you mentioned Andrew Tate, and there's a misrepresentation of stoicism. So value the values and virtues of stoicism are the filters that I put content through now, that I live my life by, right? Be of good character, acts for the common good, courage, wisdom, temperance, justice. Those things are important to me. And we arrow down and we think about those things. And the other day I had a conversation with someone and they're like, hey, you know, I've noticed a big thing. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, here's what I did. I quit drinking. I did these other things that I was very interested in being accountable. Because when I got into stoicism, it was because it was an answer to me trying to have a value system, me trying to critically think about what was the most important thing to me, which was, I don't want to be angry anymore. I don't want to be a bunch of emotional loose ends. I need a better way to perceive what's going on around me. I need a better way to respond what's going on around me. And a friend of mine sent me Ego is the Enemy. And then immediately after that, he sent me How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. And so it was on, because it was this manna from heaven that made sense to me. It was like, if I get busy not living in resentment and advocating for myself by learning about myself, by getting a job, by working hard, by filling my mind with good things, by reading James Clear, Donald Robertson, going after knowledge and information to be able to respond well to life, I've got a shot at this at like 44, right? I got a shot at this because it all made sense to me. So the way I look at stoicism is very different than is being represented or misrepresented by certain cultures. And Andrew Tate's one of them. What is your take on
the video about stoicism? Yeah. Where he talks about Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
I have to be careful when I phrase this, because I don't want to, again, sound like I'm mocking these guys around. But I watched Andrew Tate. Someone sent it to me.
This is the platform for the mocking, by the way, just to let you know.
Yeah. So I watched very closely what he said, and I couldn't really see any evidence that he'd actually read Marcus Aurelius, right? Like, so he says he's a fan of Marcus Aurelius, but he doesn't quote him or refer to any of the concepts or anything like that. He just kind of goes off at a tangent. So if you'll bear with me, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to explain some of the differences. When people talk about stoicism, we use the word stoicism today to refer sometimes like to a particular style of emotional coping, like, which has nothing to do with Stoic philosophy really. And I could define it as suppressing or concealing emotions that are unpleasant or embarrassing, or you say it's having a stiff upper lip or something like that, kind of being poker faced. And
it's generally the perception someone who doesn't understand stoicism has of stoicism is like, oh, the root word is stoic. That just means you're unemotional. Right?
But to distinguish between these two things in academic writing, we normally would write that with a lowercase s. Mm-hmm. And we capitalize stoicism when we're talking about the ancient Greco-Roman philosophy, which is built upon a much more nuanced view of emotion. So let's do a deep dive in like 30 seconds. The difference is, probably that's a bit ambitious, but we'll give it.
No, dude, take your time. Take your time. This is for me too. This is like therapy, dude.
Right? So psychologists sometimes talk about what we call folk psychology, right? Mm-hmm. Folk psychology are the psychological assumptions that everybody has that they inherit from their culture. If you think about it, we have psychological theories about how our emotions work, about how motivation works, about how we interact with other people. We just inherit a lot of psychological assumptions. A philosophy of mind, if you like, as well. And part of that is a very naive model of how emotion works. And it's sometimes called the hydraulic model of emotion, right? And Freud kind of bought into this originally. And so it's the idea that anger and anxiety are just kind of like, it's like a volume of pressure that builds up inside. It's like a blob of energy, anger, anxiety. And that we could deal with it either by kind of trying to push it down somehow, or by kind of purging ourselves of it, by venting it, like, or channeling it in a different direction, like rechanneling a river, like going to the gym and kind of getting it out of our system. So it's this well up of kind of invisible energy. That's kind of how we talk about anger, anxiety, sadness, other emotions, right? But it's a very simplistic way of understanding them. So funnily enough, when Andrew Tate talks about stoicism, the first thing he does, he say, yeah, stoicism's great. You know, when I'm really angry, he talks about sometimes suppressing it. Sometimes he talks about accepting it. He talks mainly about going to the gym and like pumping things or whatever he does. and getting it out of his system, getting his anger out of his system, right?
Yeah.
So there are the way that a modern psychologist or a cognitive therapist would understand just how emotion works is much more nuanced than that, right? It would be more like understanding how a watch works and taking it apart and seeing those different elements to it, right? So obviously, if you have no idea what's inside a watch or a clock, good luck trying to repair one, right? So if you think emotion is just like a blob of energy, you're not going to even know where to begin in terms of doing stuff to change your anger. And things like, we know that venting anger doesn't really work that well, funnily enough. Like, the research on venting anger shows that people who vent their anger or try and get it out of their system, usually it can in some cases make their anger worse rather than better. And it doesn't really seem to have that much long-term therapeutic value. The main difference, there are several differences, but one main difference is that we now view emotions much more cognitively, inspired by Stoicism. The Stoics did that first. So we would say when someone is angry, it's because they're having angry thoughts, or they have angry beliefs that shape their emotions. And that, Dean, that changes everything. And
because it requires examination.
It requires examination. It means that if you're really angry and you go to the gym and you just pump things or punch a bag or whatever it is, and then you kind of feel exhausted later, so you're maybe not as angry. Mm-hmm. But how has that in any way, shape, or form helped you to understand what the beliefs, thinking, values, attitudes were that made you get angry in the first place? It's like a band-aid solution. So say a girl, you ask a girl out on a date and she rejects you.
Never happened. This is the example. This never happened.
Gives, right?
Yeah.
Like, then you can feel, he talks about feeling this kind of furious, like, rage, you know, and this is kind of society's fault or whatever, right? But you might look around and think, I don't know, my buddy got, like, ditched by his girlfriend. He just shrugged it off and moved on. Or, you know, like, one of my other buddies, like, was upset for like a day, and you know, like, he didn't really let it get to him. It's like water off a duck's back, whatever. If he asks someone out on a date and they reject him, so why is it so upsetting to me? So first of all, you might look around and think other people feel differently about the same things. So maybe it's not the thing that's upsetting me, but rather my opinions or my thinking about it, as Epictetus said. And that would force you into self-examination, as you rightly put it. So then you would say, well, why am I getting angry about this stuff? What is it about my attitudes and my way of thinking that make me vulnerable, give me such a fragile ego, like, in the first place, that I'm prone to anger? And if I just go in to the gym and pump things or like punch a bag or whatever, that's just gonna kind of temporarily get rid of the feeling, like, but it does nothing to change the cognitive predisposition that caused it in the first place. This is why it would be impossible for Jordan Peterson or Andrew Tate or any of the kind of watered down versions of them to ever engage with cognitive therapy or engage with Stoicism properly, because it contradicts the premise, the foundation of everything that they're saying.
Of Stoicism, because they're pushing responsibility of the experience that they're having that they don't like onto other people.
Yeah.
Where Stoicism at its core tells you that your life experience is your responsibility. And so if things are going on in and around you, you have to examine what those things are. If you've got a toxic way of looking at life or perceiving life, or you're not responding to unfair properly because it's the business of life. And this is what people don't understand. You know, it's an old saying, life is a cliche. Bumper stickers make more sense to me today. A smooth water never made a great sailor. Yeah. You know, it's never been more, and it's because of Stoicism and the idea that we are not exempt from the work of life, and that what we do and the things that we choose to respond to, whether we choose to respond to them in anger or in some type of calm, you know, cognitive space where we can understand what's going around it, to the point where I tell my kids now, you know, they talk about frustration that they deal with relationships, right? They're all teenagers or young 20-odd-year-old men. And it's very important to me because I've seen that vacuum of hatred and victimology and that industry of victimology get taken over by guys like Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson, that we do the opposite in this house.
Yeah.
And Stoicism, as you can see, well, I want to talk about tattoos in just a second.
Yeah.
And the idea that responding well to life, right, amor fati, the love of fate, is that will dictate your happiness and how you choose to do it and take responsibility for yourself. And Marcus talks about being, you know, strict with himself and easy with others. It's a real, real important tenet of Stoicism, and that philosophy is an operating system, but it is, you know, stands because of what I think is important today, Donald, which I didn't 10 years ago. Thanks to ancient philosophy, something that was, you know, buried for a long period of time. The attitude of victim industry,
yes,
grosses me out to the point now where it is so transparent that I can't not mock these guys. That's my point.
The irony is, like, so they say one thing and do another, right?
Right.
So they tell you
words works.
The most common piece of advice that you find in self-improvement literature is that you have to take more responsibility for your life. But that's meaningless unless you tell people what it is that they're taking responsibility for and how to take responsibility. So what they're not telling you is that your emotions aren't like blobs of energy. They're shaped by your beliefs and values. So to take responsibility for your anger, you'd need to examine the beliefs and values that cause your anger. Like, and that they won't go near.
No.
Right? Because they want to use your anger. Like, it's part of this, the resource that they're capitalizing on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll tell you another little anecdote that kind of supports that, right? I've never heard of a cognitive therapist's prescribe books, self-help books to their clients all the time. And cool. So we're always kind of saying, why don't you try this and read this? And clients ask us about books that they're reading and stuff. I've never heard of a cognitive therapist or any evidence-based therapist prescribing Jordan Peterson's books or Andrew Tate's videos to the clients, right? Now, that might be because of the politics.
Not one colleague of yours. Nada, like, you know what? You got to watch this Peterson video.
Never heard of it, right? Like, and it's, I don't think it's because of the culture wars or the politics, no. Right? Maybe a bit, but I don't think that's the real reason. The most obvious reason from my point of view
is they don't say
it's full of shit, right? They don't give advice that's compatible with cognitive therapy. Like, they don't tell people, if someone comes into therapy, what is very common, this is the anecdote I'd tell you, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of therapy, we assess a client, right? And so we'll ask them, like, what therapy have you done before? Nowadays, we'll say, have you been doing self-help stuff, reading self-help books? What have you found helpful? What have you found not so helpful? And they'll tell us, right? And you'll get a lot of self-help junkies in therapy these days, right? People go, I've read every self-help book going, because it's a huge industry now, right? I've spent a fortune on self-help courses. I've got a huge library of self-help books. And then you might be thinking, alarm bell, right? So how come you're in my consulting room? Right? How come you've ended up in therapy if you've been consuming all of the self-improvement literature, right? And the first thing a cognitive therapist, so often the clients will think, I've tried everything and nothing works.
Sure.
And they'll be in this kind of state of hopelessness, like, because they think, I've tried every option and they'll often come and think, what can the therapist even do to help me? And often the therapist will have the experience of then saying, okay, well, let's start doing some basic cognitive therapy stuff. I mean, you've done loads of self-improvement stuff over the past, you'll be an old hand at this. So when you get angry or anxious or whatever, what thoughts are going through your mind at the time? Do you, like, what are you saying to yourself?
Can I just walk you through that for a second? Because I used to get angry and act, right? Yeah. I used to get angry and that would then become an action. And it would sometimes take me hours to get it together to the point where I could actually have a conversation, to the point where I was embarrassed and full of shame by my emotional reaction to things. And so when I decided to figure this out, the first thing I had to do was not drink. So I stopped drinking. A year and a half later, someone's like, I'm listening to you and you want to be an emotionally bulletproof individual who can survive and thrive in this world. And I'm like, yes, I do. You need to understand and accept unfair. And I'm like, okay, how does that start? And they sent me a couple of books.
Yeah.
One was Ego is the Enemy. The other was How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. And I'm like, whoa. Like, there were points in both of those books where I stopped and smiled and started laughing because it made it sound so much easier to have a good life by being a good person and not responding emotionally out of anger, right?
Yeah, it hurts us more than it hurts the people that we're angry with, right? Mm. Anger destroys us. It's like a poison. The Pythagoreans compare it to eating your own heart. Like, you know, we poison ourselves with anger.
And Aurelius was obsessed with managing his.
Yeah, Marcus Aurelius says that he had problems managing his anger. He implies it's when he was younger. But he wasn't, the histories paint the opposite picture. They say he was completely unfazed by provocation. Somebody lunged at him once in a court hearing, like they were going to throttle him. Like, and his guards had to step in to protect him. And he apparently he was completely unfazed by this. He just said, we'll adjourn and reconvene the hearing tomorrow, kind of thing. Like, it wasn't that big a deal to him. Like, but that's the story of a guy who naturally feels anger, but has managed to conquer it successfully, it seems, right? So the first thing we'd say to people is, what are the thoughts that are going through your mind? Now, the point I'll make is that people who have done every piece of self-improvement available, like spent a lot of their lives doing it, very often will say, I don't know, right? And the therapist will have to coach them through the process of becoming more self-aware and noticing what the thoughts are or the internal dialogue is when they become angry. They don't even know, Dean, right? So from our point of view, this is the very first basic stepping stone, right? You can't do any cognitive therapy until you know what the thoughts are. And once you know what the thoughts are, you go, I guess I'm telling myself, this is disgusting. How dare people not respect me? You know, I've got a right to be respected. These people are all complete and utter jerks or something like that. Might be what you're saying, for instance, right? It varies from one person to another. But then you can go, well, hang on a minute. Is that stuff all true or is it false? Is it half true? Is it exaggerated? Am I leaving information out that might be important in my thinking? Is my thinking distorted or is it completely, you know, balanced and accurate? You know, and obviously, you know, the premise of cognitive therapy is we usually notice that once we identify what those thoughts are, that our thinking is biased and distorted and it's not really accurate. It's not the whole picture. But you can't even begin doing that. If someone says, what are the thoughts going through your mind when you are angry? And you go, I don't know. I've never really thought about it. But these people believe that they've spent a large portion of their life immersed in self-help. And yet they can't answer this most basic starting point question. They haven't started the process of self-improvement. So what have they been doing for the past decade? While they've been watching all these YouTube self-improvement videos and stuff and getting angrier and angrier and then ended up in therapy. Whatever they've been doing, right, maybe it's helped them in some ways, but it definitely hasn't helped their core problem. That's why they're in therapy. And it's maybe only made it worse, right? It's glaringly obvious to cognitive therapists, like that there's a kind of misdirection or deception going on here. Like, they believe that they've been doing all this therapy and self-improvement, and yet when you ask them, it's like if somebody said they'd done loads of cookery courses, and you were like, okay, could you show me how to make an omelette? And they were like, how do you turn the stove on? Like, and you'd be like, I thought you spent years, like, studying gourmet cookery and all that. And they'd be like, I have. I've spent a fortune with some of the top chefs in the world. And you're like, but you don't know how to turn on a cooker? Like, you know.
Still like, losing your mind? Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't
make
any sense. And you don't know how to make an omelette? Like, that's what it feels like. And every cognitive therapist, you know, I'll wager, and based on my experience, experiences this on a regular basis. The clients will go, more, and it's increased as the years have gone on. They go, I've been doing loads of self-help. And yet it's clear that they lack the cognitive skills and basic understandings that would be required to do. So they've been sold a lemon in self-help terms.
Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know, and he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Hi, I'm Logan Anderson, host of the Say the Damn Score podcast. On my show, I deep dive into the sports broadcasting business by, you guessed it, talking to sportscasters. The show has featured big names like Bob Costas, Kenny Albert, and Vern Lundquist, as well as many up-and-coming broadcasters who you may not know yet, but you will know soon. Whether you're looking for professional development as a sportscaster, different career paths, or if you just want to be entertained by hearing some of the best storytellers in the world tell their own stories, this podcast is for you. You can subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can visit our website, saythedamscore.com.